The pilot may have some broken ribs. However, he is responsive, but complaining of chest pain.
A helicopter crash near the Norris Glacier. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, May 5th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, House lawmakers pass legislation to overhaul the criminal justice system.
I can't get past the fact that we're going to be letting more people out on the street and arresting less people.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Pacific University delivers a distinctive education grounded in real-world experience with life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. Apply now for fall 2016 and find out more about APU's Promise Tuition Grant and other scholarships at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
The Coast Guard is reporting that a helicopter has crashed near the Norris Glacier, and the pilot, who was the only person on board, is injured. Coast Guard Chief Petty Officer Joshua Ryan of District 17 Command says a distress beacon was detected at 2:14 p.m. He says air helicopters confirmed it was one of theirs that had crashed. Authorities have been in radio contact with dog sled tour operators on the glacier near the crash site. Ryan says those workers got the pilot out of the helicopter.
The pilot may have some broken ribs. However, he is responsive, but complaining of chest pain.
Ryan says the pilot has not been identified. He says Capital City Fire Rescue personnel and Temsco helicopters are en route to retrieve the injured pilot. An MH-60 from the Coast Guard's Air Station Sitka is also en route. The House voted 28-11 today on one of the largest overhauls ever to Alaska's criminal justice system. It would allow some low-risk nonviolent offenders to avoid jail time. It would also establish a new pretrial service program with a goal of reducing recidivism, and it would allow those in treatment programs to receive credit for time served instead of imprisonment. Both sides of the debate displayed passion over 4 days. Anchorage Republican Representative Gabrielle Ledoux says it's time for a different approach to criminal justice. She notes nearly two-thirds of inmates re-offend within 3 years.
So it's not helping them, and it's not helping the public, because they're returning and they're committing crimes. We're not getting a good return on our investment.
But Representative Charisse Millett, another Anchorage Republican, says the bill should do more to target drug and alcohol abuse. She cited the cases of 4 local residents who died as a result of substance abuse.
People decided that they needed to drink, they needed to take drugs, they needed to do all these things and kill my constituents.
The bill draws on recommendations from the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission. They include putting in place a new system to assess the risk posed by offenders and allowing low-risk offenders to avoid jail time. Juneau Republican Kathy Munoz recalled the example of her friend Mac Colnell, who she says wasn't dangerous when he was arrested. He was attacked in jail and died. Munoz says he would have benefited from the risk assessments in the bill.
If SB 91 were in place, Mark would have had a risk assessment right after being arrested, and I'm 100% sure that he would not have been held in prison and he would be alive today.
The debate reflected the challenge of balancing the goal of lowering the number of repeat offenders with concerns raised by some victims' rights advocates and law enforcement. It's this reduction in the number of prisoners that drew the most concern from bill critics. Big Lake Republican Representative Mark Newman says reducing jail time requires more drug treatment, but the bill doesn't provide money for it.
I can't get past the fact that we're going to be letting more people out on the street and arresting less people. Unless there's money for treatment.
While bill supporters say their primary goal is to reduce crime, they also point to the potential for savings. Without reducing the number of prisoners, the state will likely have to build another prison. The House and Senate will likely form a conference committee to resolve their different versions of the bill. Cook Inlet has apparently lost some of its charm for the oil and gas industry. For the first time ever, When the state offered leases for drilling and exploration in the inlet, it received no bids. State officials blame low oil prices, but as APRN's Rachel Waldholz reports, industry representatives say lawmakers aren't helping.
Sarah Erkman of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association says it comes as absolutely no surprise that companies aren't biting in Cook Inlet.
Companies are looking to make investments. They need some degree of certainty, and there is nothing but uncertainty right now in the Alaska oil and gas industry.
And the blame for that uncertainty? Erkman places it squarely on lawmakers in Juneau, who have been tied up for weeks trying to negotiate a major rewrite of the state's oil taxes. The most recent proposals would either scale back or end the state's generous subsidies for drilling in the inlet. Erkman says companies can't invest when they don't know what the tax structure will be. But state officials say while the debate in Juneau might be part of the problem, there are much bigger issues at play, like the ongoing slump in oil prices. Jim Beckham is the deputy director of the State Division of Oil and Gas.
You know, it's all a matter of perspective, and we just think the main driver of this is the low oil prices and the lack of acreage on major producing trends.
In other words, the acres being offered were in the Cook Inlet version of the boonies, far from infrastructure and expensive to develop. The state isn't worried about the future of the inlet, Beckham says, pointing out that there's plenty of activity right now. The companies Hillcorp and Fury are both producing natural gas, and last month Blue Crest Energy began producing oil. It's also not the first time the state has received no bids on a lease sale, but in the past it's been in more remote areas, like the Alaska Peninsula or the North Slope Foothills region, not usually a major basin like Cook Inlet. The next state lease sale, which will include tracts on the North Slope, is tentatively scheduled for this fall. From the Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholz in Anchorage.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, to reduce diesel, solar panels in Arctic communities.
Pre-contact, the people in Alaska was probably the most energy efficient people anywhere, being able to live in the Arctic on almost nothing.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence,
and by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
The 30-acre Sunrise wildfire north of Wasilla is now 100% contained. Mop-up operations are underway. About 30 firefighters are on the job and will remain there through the night. Governor Bill Walker today announced the formation of an 11-member tribal advisory council. As KMBA's Jacqueline Estes reports, he says the goal is to find ways to join forces to address mutual concerns.
Governor Walker says he and Lieutenant Governor Byron Malott will meet with the governor's Tribal Advisory Council quarterly or more often as the need arises.
We are very excited about the relationship we're going to build, that we're building, and it's about trust. And it's about that, about having the comfort level of discussing issues that might be uncomfortable in a setting that it's acceptable, and not only acceptable, it is invited and encouraged that we have those kinds of discussions.
Council members were nominated by tribes and were chosen by the governor to represent all the regions of the state. They have expertise in topics such as housing, subsistence, energy, and education. Lieutenant Governor Byron Malott says the state can learn from tribes through these discussions. He says tribes have developed systems of governance in transportation and health services, for instance, that serve rural needs well.
And that takes sophistication, it takes knowledge, it takes experience, and that is growing to a level where I think in many ways the tribes are leading the state and are ahead of the state, so both can benefit from a much more collaborative working relationship.
Ralph Anderson of Dillingham says Alaska Natives have an interest in doing their part to help the state prosper.
This is where we live. This is where our grandparents are born. This is where our children are born. This is where our children and grandchildren are going to bury us. So at the end of the day, your success, the state's success, is our success too. Because we want to leave behind for our children and our grandchildren our very, very best efforts.
In October of 2015, Walker signed Administrative Order 227 establishing the Governor's Advisory Tribal Council. He says it will incur no costs. Governor's office staff will provide support to the council, which will meet by teleconference. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Alaska Natives have been struggling with the failure of public education in their villages for a long time. APRN contributor Johanna Yurick looks at two communities taking control of their schools.
The Upete School District is possibly the smallest in Alaska. It's operated by residents and serves around 660 students living in three Upete villages in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, Akiachak, Akiak, and Tuluksak. This is a region where the indigenous language is still commonly spoken. The three villages form the Upete Nation in a bid to assert their autonomy. Here, elders are deeply involved in the schools.
Each of these sea peoples have their own unique name. Their food has names as well.
Residents of the Upete School District have gone to court to force the state to spend more resources to improve the schools. They've aggressively applied for funds to instruct their children in both the Western educational mode and in their traditional language and culture. That's what brought Raina Hartz to a district office 3 years ago, where she found a closet full of Upete curriculum gathering dust.
It was painful. It was really painful.
This material went beyond teaching traditional crafts. She described high-level lessons bridging Western and Upete culture. One involved navigation techniques and mathematics.
And it's explored through the traditional ways that they used to navigate to get around. And then it blends in the current Western science. And it's that fusion that is so powerful.
The reasons this material was sitting unused in a community that craved it and worked hard to get the funds to develop it are complex. Part of the problem was short-term grants that covered only curriculum development, but not the training for teachers to use it. But the larger problem facing this and other rural school districts is teacher turnover. Most teachers come from outside the region, don't speak the native language, struggle with the culture, and leave in a few years. Diane Hirschberg, director of the University of Alaska Anchorage Center for Education Policy Research, studied the issue for the state legislature.
The teachers who left really felt disconnected from the communities, dissatisfied with the support they were getting from their administration, both district level and within the school. They felt that they were dealing with behavioral issues with students, and there's just a whole list of things. And one of the pieces that's so hard with this is that the teachers may or may not have been able to manage this because they're coming from outside and they're not equipped.
Alaska has one tribal college that's interested in developing Alaska Native teachers. Pearl Brower, president of Ilisavik College in Barrow, says there's a problem finding enough students committed to teaching in rural Alaska. Local students know that rural teachers work long days and have very little time left for life outside of school.
A teacher's life isn't necessarily looked at as something really, as something others want to emulate and do. Then you also go into the fact that a lot of our residents in our villages have big families and have their own children. And are they interested in being in the classroom all day long? So I think there's just a lot going on, and we need to work and figure out how to support our teachers and support that development of a new teaching workforce.
Brower is convinced it can be done. Ilisavik is looking at various approaches. Alaska needs to find a solution because it's failing its students. Less than one in three of the state's indigenous rural students graduate, and in some places, as few as one in five get their diploma. I'm Johanna Yurick.
Solar panels will soon help power three communities in the Alaskan Arctic. The Department of Energy awarded federal funding to install panels in Kotzebue, Buckland, and Deering. KNOM's Emily Russell reports.
Energy costs are notoriously high in rural Alaska, where diesel is often barged up to remote communities. Sonny Adams is the director of alternative energy for NANA, the regional corporation for the Northwest Arctic Borough. Adams was born and raised in Kotzebue.
The cost of living in our region is 60% higher than it is in Anchorage. Our people are having to make tough choices between putting food on the table or heating their home.
While the price of diesel has dropped in recent years, Adams says climate change has made fuel deliveries more expensive.
We're not seeing the snowfall that we used to in the past, right? And whenever that happens, you're not getting the high river levels that you used to be able to barge up the fuel.
The low water levels are forcing some upriver communities like Kobuk and Ambler to fly in fuel at a much higher cost. That's one of the reasons Adams is looking towards renewable energy sources like wind and solar. Nana Corporation was recently awarded $1 million from the Department of Energy to partially fund solar panel installations in Kotzebue and the nearby communities of Buckland and Deering. Adams says all three already have wind turbines that help offset the high cost of energy.
So solar is just the next viable option.
Ingemar Mathiasen couldn't agree more. He's the energy manager for the Northwest Arctic Borough based in Kotzebue.
There's no reason for us to sit and just wait for more oil coming down the pipeline. In some respect, that's a pipe dream.
Originally from Sweden, Mathiasen moved to the Alaskan Arctic in the late 80s. He's been living off the grid and on solar power for decades, but he says those indigenous to the region have been doing it for far longer.
Pre-contact, the people in Alaska was probably the most energy-efficient people anywhere. Being able to live in the Arctic on almost nothing, with very energy-efficient houses and energy-efficient living.
But Mathiasen says oil changed all that. He points towards far-off places like Saudi Arabia that now supply diesel to remote communities like Selawik and Shugnak. With funding from the Department of Energy, both Mathiasen and Sonny Adams hope to power communities in the Northwest Arctic from more local sources. Doug McCourt from the Department of Energy says community-driven projects like the one Adams is spearheading is just what rural Alaska needs.
Solutions that work are solutions that come from Alaska, solutions that are, you know, designed and thought of and conceived and really baked in the communities.
That's easier said than done, says David Nickel. Nickel works for an energy consulting firm based in Washington State. He helps plan and implement solar projects in rural Alaska. Nickel says when companies don't shop around for the best deals, costs can soar.
Companies here need to figure out how to install it for cheaper. It is possible, but we need to stop trying to reinvent the wheel.
Nickel says training locals on installation and upkeep is the key to solar's success. Right now, he says the lack of institutional knowledge in the state is keeping costs high.
If I could have one wish right now, it would be that every single time somebody in Alaska encounters a problem with solar, whether it's legislative, insurance, financing, building, just go, okay, this problem has been encountered before by others. Let's go find out how they've solved it.
Because of all the obstacles, Nickel says powering communities solely by solar power is still a long ways off.
Realistically, rural Alaska is not going to completely get away from diesel for a long time. It'll come eventually, but it's not going to be anytime soon.
In the meantime, Sonny Adams is keeping his focus on solar. He's working to finalize the finances of the solar project. Adams says rural Alaska has to keep pushing forward.
We know that we cannot promote economic development with high energy costs. We have got to get off this diesel fuel.
Construction on the new solar panels in Kotzebue, Buckland, and Deering is set to begin in the spring of 2018. In Nome, I'm Emily Russell.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaskans and Alaska's communities and in operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The Fairbanks North Star Borough took action on an ordinance yesterday that targets high-polluting hydronic heaters. The special meeting for the vote was after lengthy public testimony on the measure last week. But as KUAC's Robert Hannon reports, the ordinance the Assembly passed differed significantly from the one offered by its sponsors.
Assemblyman Van Lawrence's original ordinance aimed to get rid of outdoor hydronic heaters, which he said are the worst emitters of PM2.5, the fine particulate pollution linked to health concerns. He and co-sponsor Matt Cooper wanted to dedicate more than $2 million exclusively to paying owners to strip the devices out of the air quality control zone. He says years of lackluster enforcement by the borough have been ineffectual.
This borough has made no real improvement in air quality in the last 3 years.
But Lawrence's intent was foiled. Immediately after the measure was taken up for discussion, Assemblymember Lance Roberts introduced amendments that shifted the ordinance intent away from outdoor hydronic heaters as a class and onto only those devices clearly demonstrated as polluters.
That's like giving someone a ticket because they have a Corvette sitting in their driveway. Hey, we know you're going to speed. We're just going to give you a ticket now.
Roberts' amendments found support from Mayor Carl Castle, who says although he worked with Lawrence and Cooper on their ordinance, still felt it made the borough look heavy-handed.
Well, I personally don't think that there are a lot of people that would be innocent burners and affected by this, but I do think there would be a couple, and I do think that the public perception is there would be a lot.
Nevertheless, the mayor said he would be aggressive about going after owners with polluting devices. After lengthy discussion, Roberts' amendments passed along with others, one which added wood stoves as targeted devices, and yet another amendment reduced the amount of additional funds dedicated to the program to $500,000. In the end, Van Lawrence told fellow assembly members they had gutted the measure.
We had anticipated requiring the dirtiest hydronic heaters to be removed, and we were going to compensate them for that. We're not doing that anymore. Most of this ordinance is now useless.
Later, during member comments, Lawrence told Mayor Castle he'd never again vote for local money being used for the change-out program. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
When people imagine Alaska's Arctic, the first thing that comes to mind usually isn't experimental art. But a new exhibit at the Anchorage Museum is getting visitors, urbanites, and art lovers to connect to the Arctic in different ways. Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes has the story.
Standing outside the Anchorage Museum during busy midday traffic, two radio producers from Brooklyn plug earbuds into an iPhone as they get ready to test a sound walk.
Should we say what a sound walk is?
Yeah, I don't know what a sound walk is.
So a sound walk is like a museum audio tour, but it's outside.
Isaac Kestenbaum has spent the last few months in Alaska as part of a project called Frontier of Change, a partnership with public radio station KNBA. Kestenbaum, along with his wife and collaborator Josie Holtzman, are about to try their mile-long sound walk for the first time, taking notes about how they can improve it for visitors in the days ahead.
Because, again, there's a lot of imagining that you have to do.
The three of us slip headphones into our ears and press play on a podcast, walking down the same route that groups of guided guests will travel.
I'd like to welcome you aboard Frontier of Change Airlines Flight 1. With nonstop service to Shaktulik by way of downtown Anchorage.
The experimental piece we're listening to isn't about Anchorage, but instead Shaktulik, a small community hundreds of miles away.
Which means you will be traveling in two places at once.
It's a little discombobulating. My eyes are looking at traffic lights and JCPenney's, but in my ears are the winds and waves you hear walking down the man-made berm separating Shaktulik's 61 homes from the Bering Sea.
Shaktulik is 1 mile long and a little bit wider than this city block.
We're not far into the tour when we start meeting folks from around the village.
Welcome to Shaktulik. Stormy Shaktulik, I should say.
Like Eugene Asiksik, the mayor.
It's changing, but to me, that's home.
A lot of what Asiksik and others talk about is the shifting climate, what warm winters, worsening storms, and a growing day-to-day fear over the weather feel like in the small town. Rounding the corner, a 15-story luxury hotel comes into view just as Shaktulik teacher Linda Bakoluk is describing how her students talk about evacuating in a flood.
11, 12 years old, they said, I'd take water, and I would take food, And I'd take Band-Aids and I'd grab my VHF, where before they grabbed their toys, their phones, their video games. You know, now their whole way of thinking is different.
The urban surroundings that can feel insulated from climate change suddenly seem a lot closer to it. At times, it's hard to tell if the airplanes I'm hearing are from the earbuds or the actual ones overhead. Same with the buzzing hum of trucks, wind, and seagulls. As Holtzman is scribbling notes after the tour is over, I ask if the Shaktulik Soundwalk downtown is supposed to be a compliment, a contradiction, or both.
The juxtaposition is really important, and I think there are moments of connection and disconnection that can be profound in different ways.
This is just one of the experimental pieces in the View from Up Here exhibit. Most, but not all, of the installations are inside the museum, although the lawn is playing host to an Arctic food forest. Derek Cote grew up in rural Canada and now teaches in Detroit. He says his video piece, Legends Are Made Here, with an accompanying score by the Anchorage Symphony Orchestra, started years ago when the museum invited him to experiment with a new format. At one point in Cote's film, the burning pink globe of a shallow sunrise outside Shishmaref is shown alongside the lush red curtain rising at Anchorage's Performing Arts Center. The movements and music harmonize on the screen, which Cote says is no accident.
I think there's a lot of dichotomy here that I've experienced, you know, sort of the urban and the rural and the remote, and I'm trying to find ways to reconcile those two.
The show's theme is loose, and most of the works look nothing alike. There are sculptures of glass and wood suspended from the ceiling like ornamental cocoons, a multimedia display of prehistoric permafrost patterns, and even a vinyl record you can hear that's made from wood burned during a bonfire in Kotzebue. Museum director Julie Decker says the idea was to give support to several artists with long-standing ties to northern regions as they explore this particular point in time for Alaska's Arctic.
I think there's always been a fascination with the Arctic and with the North, and so artists have come to these places for centuries. But there's an urgency to the story now, and there's a increased curiosity because of the rapid pace of change.
The View from Up Here opens Friday and runs through October 6th. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Jeremy Shea and Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Zachariah Hughes, Rachel Waldholtz, Jacqueline Estes, Johanna Urick, and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Robert Hannon in Fairbanks, and Emily Russell in Nome. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Commercial, sport, subsistence, personal use. Some hear these labels and think conflict. The Salmon Project sees connections. Join 10,000 Alaskans whose lives are connected by Alaska salmon. Visit salmonlife.org to experience the stories. And find the Salmon Project on Facebook to join the community. Salmon Life, Salmon Love. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project. Alaska Public Media is seeking donations for our 2016 Big Alaska Statewide TV Travel Auction to be held on May 19th and 20th. We're looking for trips, accommodations, activities, and adventures. Your generous donation will help us in our commitment to growth and excellence in programming on Alaska Public Media. There's more information online on our events page on our website at alaskapublic.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.